Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
So now we're going to continue from where we left off last Sunday. So we're still with this chapter 14, Praising the Mysterious. We look at reason and do not see it. Now, you know, the eternal reason is what Lao Tzu is talking about, which is not our reasoning. It is reason. And it's not the reason for anything. It is reason. It's translated as reason. We look at reason and do not see it. Its name is colorless. We listen to reason and do not hear it. Its name is soundless. We grope for reason and do not grasp it. Its name is bodiless. These three things cannot further be analyzed. Thus they are combined and conceived as a unity which on its surface is not clear and in its depth is not obscure. Forever and a, reason remains unnameable, and again it returns home to non-existence. And this is called the form of the formless, the image of the imageless. This is called transcendentally abstruse. By holding fast to the reason of the ancients, the present is mastered, and the origin of the past is understood, and this is called reason's clue. Now the Greeks, they all, you know, had a word for it. They had a word for everything, and you know, we borrowed a lot of them. The Greek word methodos, you know, comes from the root odos, which means path, and it's combined with meta, which sometimes means beyond or transcends, and sometimes it simply means according to the path. Now we've got here. You know, Aristotle, he wrote the De Tum de Physica, which was about the physical world, physics. He wrote a book on physics. And when he got to the end of it, he said, now, if you want to know anything about metaphysics, that which goes beyond the physics, then I recommend that you go to my teacher, Plato. Yeah. So, according to the path, which is beyond what we see and hear and so on, huh? According to the way, because the Tao Te Ching is also called the way, see, according to the right way, the correct way, which means truth, the truth which is beyond the everyday mind, see, the metta. Now, Tao also has the meaning of a word, you know, in the religious sense, that which in our Bible has been translated as word. So, in the beginning was the word, or as they say, in the beginning was Tao. In the beginning was the eternal reason. So, the reason, you know, we have word, they have reason. Reason, the Jan Dao, of man, which comes from this eternal reason. But the jantao of man is the process that we have of being able to rationalize. Comes from this reason. And we can rationalize in error as well as any other way, as we should well know by now. And eternal reason is called the Chang Dao, or the Tian Tao, Tian Dao, Tian Dao, heaven's reason, Tian Dao. There's another word, it's called Tian Li. Do you know, anybody here know what that is? David does. What is it, David?
Your name.
That's right. Heaven's law. The law of heaven. Oh. Well, you know, in the Yao Gong, Fei Chung Dao Ming, Ko Ming, Fei Chung Ming, Yu Ming, Wang Wu Chi Mu, Yu Ming. TNT, see, it's in there. TNT. Chi Mu. Now, Lao Tzu, the message that he gives in this Tao Te Ching, is to let heaven's reason, or this eternal reason, to let it prevail in you. It comes first. And the individual who is guided by this eternal reason is called master. He is a holy man. He's called the Shanjan, which is the man of reason. Reason. He's a man of truth. Dao is reason. And they write it as with a capital, reason. Reason. So, to remind us, it is not to be confused with the reason of the rationalist, nor the rationality of arguments. It is a reason. It is a universal world order. Something like a dharma. Yeah? And sometimes it's called a divine dispensation. That's a good theological term that they use a lot. Divine dispensation. This happens because it's divine dispensation. God gave it out this way. See, this Christos, Logos, to which man looks to with great reverence, because it's something greater than he is, even bigger than his own ego. Imagine. Although it's unknown, and that's why we can accept it. If it were known, nobody would accept it anymore because, you know, what's bigger than my ego? Not much. So, now another translation of this is what is invisible when looked at is called ye. What is inaudible when listened to is called thi. What is elusive when grabbed at is called wei. These three are not amenable to investigation. Therefore, they mingle as one. On rising, one does not become bright. On falling, it does not become dark. Unnameable, it goes on and on and on and on, and again reverts to non-being. And this is called the image of the imageless and the form of the formless. And this is also called the winking, waning. Winking, waning, winking, waning, winking, waning. Huh? Yeah. See, on greeting it, one cannot see its front. On following it, one cannot see its back. Taking hold of the Tao of antiquity to cope with the problem of the present could make one know the ancient origins. And this is called the unbroken strand of Tao. It has continuity as well as unity. So there is just something which we can't see, we can't hear, and we can't touch. Now, how are we going to investigate this? We cannot make any experiments with it, like put it over here and will it melt, and put it over here and will it freeze, and nothing, you know, we can't do any of that. So it is then considered greater than we are, and it is considered as a universal being before the seeming differentiations. Before the rising of the multiplicity, there is something. There is this universal being. There is something that we call universal being or eternal being, which is before the 10,000 things arise. This is what we call phenomenal world. There is something before all of this, and something that still is, even though all of this is, it hasn't dispersed itself, even though it stands with this 10,000 things that we also call becoming. Now, as such, as that which it is, you know, being, it cannot be contacted with our senses. So we can't assign any attribute to it, although we do. No, we should not give it anything. We should not endow it with anything. I mean, how do you know? You would say it's good. It's loving. It's kind. How do you know? You don't know anything about it. I mean, you can't touch it, you can't grasp it, you can't hear it, and you can't see it. How do you know it is? So one should not give anything, endow it with anything. Let it be as it is, you know, so that you can see it. We shouldn't say it's brightness. We shouldn't say it's darkness. It has no name, huh? And yet it exists, and it exists. And it exists, and it's on and on and on and on. And then all of a sudden it reverts, and it goes back to, that is, it returns, this being returns to non-being. Or what the Zenists call non-existence. It's strange, huh? They speak of it as being empty, of being void. It's non-existence. So is it nothing, this non-existence? Is it nothing? And yet, we must stop and consider that everything that we see and hear and taste and touch, all of this, all the myriad things are derived from this non-existence. And now, and we also know in physics that nothing can come from nothing. I mean, if you have nothing, you can't, nothing comes from it. Nothing comes from nothing. So how can this be a nothing if all of this has come from it? Oh, well, and is it something? Well, we can't see it. We can't smell it. It's to our senses, it is elusive and it is evasive. It winks at us and immediately wanes. Winking, waning, like the moon. It's full and then it's dark. You know, Zenists, they use this moon phrase for so many things. Like the nun who's carrying a bucket of water and she looks down and the moon is in the bucket. And the bottom dropped out all of a sudden. No water, no moon. And all of a sudden she had realization. Winking, waning. It doesn't have a front. It doesn't have a back. That is, it has no beginning, and it has no ending. And in the Avatamsaka Sutra, you know, they talk about it. And you will remember we discussed this at one time about it ends at the beginning and it begins at the ending. This is the Avatamsaka. You remember that, of course. I'll do it again someday. Maybe that time it'll stick. You know, you got to stick some of these things in your mind. You might as well do some of this as well as all everything else that's going out there. Now, our intellect, our ability to rationalize, our intellect, not our intelligence. Do not confuse these two. Our intellect. As soon as we begin to use it, it breaks everything in two. It separates everything. And all the statements that come from the intellect, our ratiocinations, they are incomplete. They never tell the total of anything. Now, we say, you know, God is light, and it says so in the Bible, and it says so in the Quran, and it says so in the Upanishads. And we could say, well, in a way, because we're not supposed to give any attributes, we're not supposed to endow it with anything, it shows what we want. It shows our sentiments. It's light. It's bright. See? It shows our emotions. We're elated with this. And it shows our expectations. We're going to go on and be this brightness. You know, heaven forbid we should be anything else. Yeah. But that doesn't state the fact. You know, what about darkness? You know, if God has everything, what about darkness? There is such a thing as darkness, huh? There is a light by which we live. There is a light that keeps his planet together. And it's a light, the same light that keeps this solar system in order. It's the light of the sun, we call it, huh? Is it really light? The light of the sun, is it really light? Or is it that just the way that it appears to us? Maybe the light that we see is the image of the sun. And the sun is, you know, very often considered as a symbol for the crystals. Yeah. And we live and we can exist on this planet because of it. And when it's gone, we can no longer exist on this planet because the planet will begin to disintegrate. Yeah. Just as we exist by the Logos, or the Tao, or the Buddha nature, or however you want to call it. And we look at the sun, and if we look at it directly and do it long enough, we will be blind because of the strong light. And yet you stand right next to the sun, and there isn't any light at all. It's all dark. So what does your mind do with something like that unless you've already been told so that you have an answer? I mean, what does your mind do with it? That here it's all this sunshine and it keeps everything alive and we're growing and the plants are growing and the ground is enriched because of it and we have chlorophyll around because of the sun because the plants take the energy from the sun, send it to the roots and it comes back and they throw off this chlorophyll that we helps to keep the air clean. Helps us to survive. And now when you get there, there isn't any light at all. Where do you go with that? Yeah. The old Chinese used to say, the ancients, you know what they call them. They always said, not to. God is not to. But we perceive things in two-nesses, or however you want to say it. Two, huh? And here we're perceiving everything in twos, and we're looking for a one. And in all of this two-nesses, we're looking for a one, and we don't seem to be able to find a one. We look, and we look, and we look, and of course we're looking with our two-ness. If one could set aside the way one thinks, which is extremely difficult, but if you could set it aside for a split second, you know, and then look, Do you think you would find beautiful and ugly things? No. Things will be viewed as they are. And, you know, the mind has not set them aside in this two-ness, that this is beautiful, this is ugly. That's two-ness. This, you know, there's none of that. Beautiful and ugly. When things are viewed other than through the prism of the mind, the mind is considered to be like a prism. And when seen outside of this prism, here we are, it is colorless, it is inaudible, and it is not two. It's very interesting. It's an interesting study, this the rays, or shall we say, the energy of the sun. The energy of the sun divides and becomes color. And the minute the prism is gone, all these rays again unite. It's all one. And all color is gone. There isn't any color. You divide and the colors are born. And boy, how we like these colors, huh? Oh, my. Yep. So then people, you know, then there comes this other study about why do we like these colors so much? I mean, it makes the world go round somehow. You know, we say that, okay, some people like certain colors, and we say, well, okay, that's red. Okay, that's a kind of a passion or an anger or something like this. Great passion, huh? And blue is cool, and it's devotion. They say these things, you know. And green is activity, and green is also envy. And yellow represents mentality, the mental processes. And then there's orange for harmony. And let's see, we've got purple. Purple? No, purple isn't in there. Lavender? No, lavender is not in there. Anyway, so our color, our passions, our emotions, color, they color our lives. And we like this. You know, we not only think, but we want lots of color to our thinking. So we have all of this going on. See, we think that without these colors in it, why, our lives would be pretty flat. Well, that's not necessarily true. Because if you step aside from them, there would be totality rather than the flatness. Hmm? You know, we have a rainbow, and when the sun comes out after a rain squall, and the world is still wet and drippy, and all of a sudden, you know, there's a rainbow up in the sky. The moisture acts as a prism. Where did the color come from? Does it come from the water, or does it come from the sun? Where is the blue of the sky? We go out and you see these white, billowy clouds, you know, and the sky is so blue lately, and you look, where'd the blue come from? Is the blue in the sky, or is the blue in you? And why do we all see blue? We all, blue sky, blue, beautiful blue. From whence cometh this? There is a kind of a stimulation in light. We're stimulated by it. In darkness, there is tranquility. Light has a boundary. Darkness has no boundary. Light comes and goes. It waxes and it wanes. Darkness is forever. Light comes from a source. Darkness has no source. We designate God as light. Makes us feel more secure. You know, this is the way we do. You know, we endow things to make us feel better. So throughout all these long centuries of mankind, there have been those also who believe that God is darkness. I think the ancient Essenes were one of these people, tribes, groups. But again, you see, so here they believe that God is darkness. There was a time when human beings believed that God was a woman instead of a man. And I guess we're coming back to that now. See, all of it, though, it's half-truths. It's only half-true. If there is what we call light and dark, except both together, both are together. Those who worship only the light deny the dark. They've only got half of it, huh? Those who worship the dark deny the light, and they've only got half of it. And then what do you do when you replace the words light and dark with good and evil? Looked at but cannot be seen. Now I see my hands, but where can I see God? I have looked all over. The Russians, you know, said they paid attention when they were out in space, and they looked and looked and looked, and they didn't see any God up there. I saw a headline the other day, though, in the, what was it, the National Enquirer or whatever it is. It's in the new... somebody has discovered heaven. Happy day. See, you don't have to worry. You don't have to sit. You don't have to pay attention to yourself. You don't have to do anything. You just wait. There is heaven up there. So as long now as you're sitting there and seeing things, objects, you know that you haven't seen God. But although we know that through the process, we do see things, because we are objectively self-conscious, and we in splitting something inside. You know, first of all, when you have something, you're identified with it like this, and you cannot see it, you see. Then comes along this pressure that you put on it, this energy that you're exerting to be able to see, and the thing goes like this. You know, again, the whole thing waxes and wanes, huh? Winking, waning, blim, blim, and you get a glimpse. That in that split second, it has become an object that you can see. We are objectively conscious. We see. So always my question to you is, what or who is seeing that object? And that is what is important. You know, in this meditation process, you know, there have been people who say, well, they've seen Jesus, and they've seen Buddha, they've seen Krishna, they're Indians, East Indians, you know, and so on. Our Western Indians, they don't, in the few books I've read about seeing anything. They don't talk about meditation either, do they? But they do it? No. Anyway, you haven't seen God, you haven't seen Krishna, you haven't seen Buddha, and you haven't seen Jesus. And that's where this expression comes from, you know. If you meet the Buddha on the way, kill him. Because you are not seeing what is for real. You're seeing something that the mind has thrown up to you for the moment. This is what they are talking about. Huh? Do not accept any old thing as being real. Just don't sit there and accept. Oh, look what I saw. No. No matter how excited you may get for the moment, sit back and look at this thing and see what you're doing. Now, look around a little bit. You know. If you have eyes, in the sense that Jesus meant, if you have eyes, then see. And if you have ears, hear. Now, if you have eyes and you look around, what do you think you are looking at? I mean, you look around now, and what do you think you are looking at now? Well, I'll tell you. With the physical eye, you're looking at images. You're looking at mental constructs. And this empty space is one of your mental constructs. It is a concept. This. So now what is it really? Listen to but not heard. We are so involved with the audible, that which can be heard. And we do know science, physics, or whatever you want to call it, has come to the place where they say that every object has its own vibrations or frequencies and wavelengths, whichever term you want to use, and therefore it has a sound. Then I read once where in England they had discovered that Venus emits the sound of C on a scale, music scale, C. I wonder what other planets around this Earth hear from this planet. All things, all objects can be heard. Only God is inaudible. This is this tremendous silence that you can go into and go deeper and deeper and deeper until there's God. You listen and discard the sound, and you listen and discard the sound. It's the same thing as doing neti neti in another way. You listen and discard it. You listen, that's not it, and that's not it. And you do that until only the silence remains. See? When the ears finally stop all outside sound, then what is heard is the inaudible. Yeah? You know the inaudible? And now, out of the Upanishad, we have another little story. And you know this little boy, Svetketu. You know, he's the one that was sent away to school, and he came back and finally brought the, and talked to his father about what he had learned. And the father said, you go pick the fruit of the Roda tree, and you know, the seeds, and this is not, and this is not, and this is fine, there's nothing. Well, we got another story about him. He comes home again, this, you know, with a study of the sutras, and his father asks him right away, you have learned everything that could be heard, but have you heard that which cannot be heard? Now, this boy was very proud of his attainment. And he was confident that he knew everything that could be known. And his father was going to be so proud of him when he came home. And now the very first thing is this question. Can you or did you hear that which was inaudible? Which is inaudible? I worked so hard all these years and that's what I get? This kind of a question? And he says, well, I don't know of this kind of a teaching. But if God is inaudible, then what you say, then God cannot be in the sutra. You know, because these you can read and you can talk about and this is sound. So he's not in there. And he says, I have not heard the inaudible. So the father says to the son, you go back. You go back to this teacher. I sent you to become a Brahman. And you can only call yourself a true Brahman when you hear the inaudible. Now go. Go back. So the boy did as he was told, you know, and he went to his teacher, his guru, and he told him what the father had said, you know, that he was to hear the inaudible. And this guru just shook his head and said, I can only tell you what can be told. I can only tell you what can be told. How can I tell you that which cannot be heard? So, Well, I can't go home until I've heard the inaudible. Well, they thought about it for a while, and the guru finally says to him, I'll tell you what you do. You take these cows of the ashram, this little center where he did his teaching, you know. You take these cows, and you go deep into the jungle, and do not return until there are 1,000 cows. There were about 400 at the time. So he takes, you know, these 400 cows, they have got to be, you can come back when there are 1,000. And the kid says, what am I going to do in the jungle? You know? And this guru says, you're going to forget about yourself. You worry about the cows. You get completely involved in the service of the cows. You're going to serve the cows. And when there are 1,000 of them, then you can return. So he did. He went deep into the jungles, you know, and he tended the cattle out there. He gave them water, and he fed them, and he brushed them, and he, you know, took a while. Anyway, and he saw to it that they were well rested, well tended, and he passed his days serving the cows. And he did it with a one-pointed attention, cows. And the years came, and the years went. Watching the stars at night, he went to sleep, and with the sun coming up in the morning, he woke up. There was no one to talk to. Only these cotton-picking cows, you know, with their blank, doleful eyes. Yeah. And more and more and more, he forgot himself. Then, as the story goes, one day the cows gathered round him, and they addressed him. And they said, Setketu, we now number 1,000. It is time to go home. And they went, and the guru saw Setketu coming, and he recognized immediately what had happened. And then the boy returned to his father. He's not a boy anymore. Setketu, we call him. And as he came into the village, his father was looking out of a window, and he saw him coming. And so he went to his wife and said, Setketu is coming down the street, and he is returning as a true Brahman. Now he will come, and he will touch my feet, and I shall be in a terrible dilemma. I am not yet attained. I have not yet heard the inaudible. And he has. So I am leaving. And he went out by the back door. Yeah. Cows. I had an experience with cows once. You don't want to hear that. They're not all so doleful. Terrible. Grasp that, but cannot be touched. When we try to comprehend something, what do? What is our process of comprehension? When you want to know something, you want to comprehend something, what do? Supposing somebody brought a very strange animal in here. You know, it's got horns and a halo and tail and hoofs and is colored pretty blue, whatever. Yeah. They bring it in here. It's got feathers instead of fur. You look at this thing and you think, what is this, you know? And now somebody asks you, what about this thing? What do you do? What do you do mentally? What do? I mean, physically you might want to run away, but mentally what do? Huh? So we begin. We're going to want to know what this thing is. We begin by comparison. We compare what we know with what we don't know. We compare what we know about animals and looking at this animal. Well, it's not a cow, and it's not a dog, and it's not a cat, and so on and so on. But we reduce in this way, or we try to reduce in this way, the unknown to a language. And with the language, we think we know. We think we understand because we can say something about it. You read a book, whatever the book is about. You can read it on religion, you can read it on philosophy, you can read it on psychology, you can read it on gardening, you can read it whatever, you know? And you say when you're through with the book, oh, now I know. Well, what do you know? Do they tell you that you have to plant certain seeds by the light of the sun, the light of the moon, and certain seeds by the dark of the moon? You know, when you read books and stuff like that there, which is very entertaining, and we do accumulate information about it, and some of it is extremely helpful. So please do read. Most teachers will tell you don't read. I'm saying read. But what you're doing is getting acquainted with someone's theory, with someone's ideas about. It doesn't mean it's true. It can be miles away from the truth. But some people, because they can read something somewhere, that becomes the truth, the unadulterated truth. It's like some people, when they say something, immediately, something springs out of their mouth, but because they've said it, it becomes the truth. I know people like that. Be a little careful what you swallow, you know? And I say it again and again and again. Be careful what you swallow. Do not deceive yourself. You're dealing in theories. Points of view. Now, we live in this very limited world of ours. We see the truth, and we hear reality, and we touch reality, and we touch the truth. Now, our eyes are limited, our ears are limited, and our hands can only grasp a thing. See? You can't grasp this, you know? And yet here we sit with all of the truth of the universe surrounding us. And all we can say is, it's so elusive. Queen Zenji said it, surrounded by water, up to our necks in water, up to our ears in water, and yet we thirst. So you know what they say? Just dunk your head. That's all. Bow your head. That's all it takes. Bow the head. Difficult, huh? Senses operate within their boundaries. But senses can experience are limited. So when we set out to know this vastness, which we are told surrounds us, and somehow we know this, that there is something greater than us that surrounds us. And see, and all of a sudden our words become useless because they are limiting. These are limitations. You know, if you have a wonderful idea and you would like to put it in a box, how do you do this? You talk about it. The minute you talk about something, you have got it in a box. You are limiting it. You see, this is why they say teachers shouldn't talk. They shouldn't get up and give talks. Because they're leading you astray. Because they're giving you all these presents. Boxes of boxes and boxes of things. Which have to be taken away again. And yet at the same time, it's very important that you listen. Because otherwise you get kind of lost as where you're going in your meditation. And what is expected of you in the meditation, huh? Yeah. Anyway, senses are important. And we have learned to analyze because we have these senses. But the minute we start analyzing something, we split the world in two. We got near and far, high and low, and hot and cold, etc. All of which is very necessary in this phenomenal world of ours. You know, it's kind of dumb, you know, to get on the freeway. You pull on the freeway and you wonder, gee, I wonder if that the place down, what do they call it, the where they check, checkpoint?
Border crossing.
Border crossing. I wonder if it's open or if it's closed. And all of a sudden you see it, you know. And then you drive and drive and drive and drive, and you think there's something wrong here, you know, because you got to drive and drive and drive to get there. You know? Well, anyway. Some things that we know, some things in this phenomenal world are seem to be too, because we have now like hot and cold. See, hot is a measure of cold, and cold is a measure of hot, isn't it? Yeah, so it's still all one. But if you did not have the sense of hot or the sense of cold, you could injure yourself terribly. So the senses are also our protection. Huh? But we must at the same time realize what the senses report are not two things. This is what we've done with these polar opposites. We've made two things out of them. And this is so what we've done with this whole manifestation or this expression, you know. And we say we live life. Well, where did it begin? You know, with your birth? No. That is the birth of a manifestation, of an expression of life itself. Hmm? Yeah. And when you leave this world, does life die? No. No. The body disintegrates. It may, but not life. Life doesn't die. We come and go. Life goes on forever. And if we could live like St. Paul, you know, and he said, you know, I die daily. And he lived through the whole thing. I die daily. And I die daily so that the new man might live more fully. The Christos, you know, the experience that he had, and the Christos in him was living, was a living. And he wanted to help it grow into greater proportions. So he said, I die daily so that he might live. Every day he cleaned out a little more, you know. You know, we talk every now and then about surrender. That's what Paul did. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes surrendering is somewhat misunderstood, possible. A religious person talks about surrender, but at the same time is very reluctant to do so, to surrender. Mm-hmm. Can you surrender? You say you're willing to surrender. Are you really? Can you give up one concept as to what you think for actual knowledge, for actual knowing? Can you give up, can you surrender enough to give up one lousy concept? Difficult. I mean difficult. And do you know how many concepts you do hold on to? It is incredible. And Jesus, you know, said, I will bring you the life more abundant. He didn't say, I'm going to bring you cars and TVs and radios and diamond rings. I bring you life more abundant. Just follow me. And then, of course, he went through his ordeal. And the life did not die. See? Did it, according to the story. Life didn't die. He came back, all living. You know, the word life, it's like we put something in a box. Life represents something. It means something. It represents something. There is something tangible. Not with hands. But there is something, and we call it life. It's like the word love. See, the word love represents something. It represents a force, if nothing, or an energy. And the word hate represents something. And it's on and on and on with our words. They represent something. Words representing. But what the word represents is not visible, and it's not audible, and it's not graspable. And so we settle for the words, and we come out on the short end. Yeah. Now, there you sit. What or whom do you represent? These are all expressions of. We call everything an expression of the particular state. That means us too. You know, we represent something. What do you represent? Yeah. So you want to know what you're a manifestation of? Well, then you have to do a little surrendering, huh? Yeah, I'm not asking a lot. You know, it's a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit here and a bit over there. Not much. A little bit. Until the ego is all gone. See, it's swallowed by the dragon. Yeah, because in China, you know, the dragon represents the divine force. And it is this dragon of the divine force that carries the pearl of the great price in its mouth. And we have to rescue that pearl for ourselves. Now, how do you go about doing this? Well, in order to know a dragon, you have to enter its hide. As long as this I is perched upon the throne, there is no place for him. You know, Zen people say, when a guest arrives, we make room for him. He who goes to invite the supreme guest must vacate the arena. Because when he comes in, there is no room for the ego. And Aleister Crowley, you know, he said once upon a time, you sit down, and you shut up, and you get out. Yeah? I'm going to quit. You're either falling asleep, or you're getting antsy, or something is going on here. And I've talked long enough anyway. So, now, we leave the chairs up. Meeting tonight. And we will have our board meeting. And while you depart from here, may the peace follow you wherever you go. And may you understand the understanding that is beyond all understanding. All the while, the love of the Christos holds us, and we are not separate. And I thank you for coming.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.